Okay, welcome back. In reality, so we go to lecture 9, page 6. Lecture 9, page 6, where we start with the mixed binomial model and the sort of reason for this and the reason for what is coming in the rest of this course is that the assumption of independence between defaults is just altogether too optimistic. Sort of the shape of the economy changes, and this affects not just in one individual obligor, but typically all of the obligors. So there's sort of a dependence. If the economy is in a bad shape, if Corona has just arrived, then there'll be many more defaults in some areas at least than there are in usual good times. So one has to include some kind of dependence into the models to get models which are reasonably realistic. For example, I mean, during Corona, to assume that airlines default independently of one another in the same way as they defaulted a year ago is just doesn't make any sense. So one somehow, if you want to do realistic modeling, you will have to include dependence. And we'll do it now in the simplest possible way, which is using the mixed binomial model. So this is on page 6 of lecture 9, page 6. And the way it's done is one randomizes the default probability, and this leads to stronger dependence. It works as follows. We start with a random variable, which may be discrete or continuous, but typically it's continuous. And we'll let p of x be a function which is restricted to take values in the zero, in the interval 0 to 1, so that it could be a probability. And then we also have that p of z is a random variable. And of course, regardless of where z takes its values and p of z takes values in 0, 1, so it could act as a probability. So we start with a z, and then we get the p of z, which is a random variable, which is in the interval 0 to 1. And then we construct random variables x1, x2, xm, so that they are conditional on z, they are independent, and each xi has default probability p of z. That is that the probability that xi equals 1 given z equals to p of z. So the x's are now not independent, but they are conditionally independent. Conditional on z, they are independent. And with default probability p of z, but then they become dependent because they have the default probabilities changes, and so if p of z is closer to 1, then all the obligors are more likely to default. The risk of default is bigger for each obligor than if p of z happens to by chance take a small values. Okay, so the intuition behind this is sort of what I tried to say before, that the default probability C is represents sort of a common background, the state of the economy, which affects all obligors in the portfolio in the same way. So that's the idea. Some years the default probabilities are higher, some years the default probabilities are lower, depending on the state of the economy. So three models we look at with where there is mixed binomial models. This is on page 7 of lecture 9. And the first model is a mixed binomial model where p of z equals z and z has a beta distribution. And by now you've surely looked up the beta distribution, and you know it's a family of distributions for variables which takes values of 0, 1. So it's okay to take P of z just equal to be the identity, to let P of z equals z, because z anyway takes values in 0, 1, so you can can act as a probability. And of course, choosing the beta distribution, it's a very flexible family of distributions. You can get very many unimodal shapes on 0, 1 by choosing the parameters of the beta distribution in suitable ways. That's two parameters. And so this is sort of a bit ad hoc. It just says we try to find a flexible class of distributions, and then we use that as mixing distributions. The example two is a logic normal distribution for P of C, which means that P of C has a formula you can see in example two. And its formula is that P of Z equals 1 over 1 plus e to the minus mu plus sigma Z, where Z is a standard normal random variable. And you can look at it and you can see that this P of Z must take values between 0 and 1 because the exponential is positive. So you have 1 divided by something which is greater than or equal to 1 and which is positive. So you must get a value for P of Z which is in 0 to 1. And this model is a little bit less ad hoc than the mixed binomial model, but in this course we don't really go into the reason for this. And one more comment for example two is that in the exponent you have mu plus sigma z, where z is standard normal. You could equally well just have written this as z, where the z has a normal distribution with mean mu and standard deviation sigma. It's just two different ways of writing the same thing. And of course, the minus sign, if you want to, you could take away too, because minus a normal variable is another normal variable. Okay. The third example, which is the Merton model, or the mixed binomial model inspired by the Merton model, if one wants to be more sort of formally correct, is given by the formula in example three. And this has sort of a much more detailed motivation. It starts by a model for the behavior of sort of the resources of the individual obligers, how much money the individual obligers have. And then it says, and this is a model which is a geometric Brownian motion, and then it says that if the resources become too small, or if the negative resources become too big, then the obliger defaults. And this geometric Brownian motion has two parameters, a mu and a sigma, where sigma is a so-called volatility. It says how big the variations in the resources of the obliger. It describes how big these variations are. And then doing computations from starting with this underlying model, one gets the formula for P of Z, which is on the bottom formula. And here you should remember that N is a standard normal distribution function. N minus 1 is its inverse. P bar, well, that's the P, so the sort of the average default probability. And rho is a correlation parameter. It comes, I mean, it is derived from the mu and the sigma, but now this is the only thing which occurs here. So this is the Merton model. And it's sort of has a clearer connection to the underlying behavior of the obligers, and therefore is maybe the most popular model, and it's used quite widely in practice. The next thing on page 8 of lecture 9 is a large portfolio approximation. And then for it, you should remember that NM was the number of defaults in the portfolio. M, little m, is the size of the portfolio. N, capital N, little m, is the number of defaults. If you look at the ratio between capital M, NM, and M, then you get the frequency of default. And the large portfolio approximation says that the probability that NM divided by M is less than or equal to X, that tends to the probability that P of Z is less than or equal to X when M tends to infinity. And this is sort of obvious if you know the large law of large numbers. Of P of Z is just a constant. P of Z is just a constant. So you have the binomial model where you have IID defaults. Then this is just the law of large numbers. If you have dependence, you first condition on P of Z and then use the law of large numbers, and then you get this result. So it's somehow pretty understandable, even if it's not proved. But it's quite useful. And this distribution, the probability that P of C is less than or equal to X, is called the large portfolio approximation, LPA, to the distribution of NM over M. And it's useful for computation in large portfolios, but it's perhaps even more, but nowadays simulations makes it possible to handle actually pretty large portfolios too. So from a computational point of view, it's maybe becoming a bit less important now than it was when it was invented a long time ago. But it still is important because it gives you understanding. You understand how things behave. So it's a quite important result. Okay, in the lecture notes are quite a lot of discussion of generalized inverses, and that's typical in this literature. In general, in the financial risk literature, there's a lot of fairly complicated discussion of generalized inverses. I think it's maybe not all that complicated. I tried to explain it in this next, on page 9 of lecture 9. And you remember sort of what an inverse is. And what I have is three plots of the same function. It's a distribution function. So it's non-decreasing. It can have jumps. And then you want to compute the inverse of this function. And what you do then is you take a value on the y-axis, and then you want to know which value on the x-axis gives rise to this y-value. That's the sort of how you think about inverses. So now the way of saying it is that the inverse should have the property that f taken at the inverse of f of y at y should be equal to y. So the inverse of y, the sort of simple, the first course in calculus definition of inverses, which works for strictly increasing continuous function, is that f of f minus 1 of y should equal to y. And this is what you can see in the top left plot. There you have look at the part where the then you look at the y, which when you draw it out, it hits a part of the function f of x where it's continuous and strictly increasing. So then it's clear that the inverse has to be as is shown on the picture. Now, if you look at the top right plot, then the y is such that it happens to be at the point where the function jumps. So the function actually doesn't ever take this value y. It takes, but then it's still clear what should be the inverse. It should be, of course, the sort of point where the jump happens. So the generalized inverse here, quite obviously, should be as shown in the plot. And in this case, when you have if f is a distribution function, cumulative distribution function, then by definition, it's really an arbitrary definition. It is right continuous. So then f of f inverse of y will be sort of the little dot up on top of the blue vertical line. So that's no choice. That's the way you have to define the inverse, a generalized inverse. But on the bottom, the situation is more complicated. There, the y is such that you, if you draw it out towards the graph, then you hit a flat portion of the f of x. And then what should one use as inverse? Well, any value in the red interval, in the flat, the interval which corresponds to the flat part of the graph of f of x could be an inverse, because then f of any x which is in the red interval will be equal to y. So if you take any value in the red interval, then you get f of this value will be equal to y. So it's unclear how should we define an inverse here, and then one defines it completely arbitrarily as the leftmost point in the interval, and then you get the, as you would have gotten for any other definition in the interval, you get that f of f inverse of y equals y. So these are the three cases, and that's what motivates the definition of generalized inverse, and I hope this makes it a bit simpler than it would have than all the formulas. Okay, just the next slide 10 is just a formula for the correlations in a mixed binomial model. It's sort of a way of understanding dependence, so I thought I'd just add the formula. Finally, the final page is on Monte Carlo simulation, stochastic simulation of portfolio credit loss. And that's important. Monte Carlo methods, simulation methods, are fantastically important in sort of all kinds of probability theory, statistics, and other parts of mathematics, because it's a computational method which often works where other methods don't work. So it's quite important. And in this, in the credit risk lectures, it can be used to find value at risk and expected shortfall. And the way it goes is as follows. First, you decide on how many simulations you want to do, 100,000 or 1,000,000 or whatever. And there always to make this is a sort of a numerical method. It becomes more accurate the more simulations you do. So you should make n as large as you can, but not to make it too time consuming. If you do it in this kind of setting, maybe you do simulations which take 2 or 3 minutes to do on your desktop or your laptop computer, rather your laptop computer. If you do serious science, you might use many more, have much more complicated situations and do simulations which take several days. That's sort of what's done in climate science often, for example. But here you should choose n as large as conveniently possible to make the simulation take maybe 2-3 minutes or something like that. Okay, then what you do is, once you decided on the n, which you maybe decide by taking a reasonably not such a big n, see how long time it takes. If it works, then make a bigger n. And of course the n shouldn't be also a restriction, is that so that the result should not fill up the entire memory of your laptop. But what you do then, what you do is you decide on n, the number of simulation, the 100,000 or whatever. Then you repeat 3-5 steps in n times. And for each step you do as follows. So for j equals 1, in the first step, you first simulate a random variable z, say maybe a beta random variable or a normal random variable. Then you compute p of z. That's of course simple, it's just a formula. Then you simulate m IID, uniformly distributed random variables. So M is the portfolio size, the number of obligers. And you simulate in step 2 M of these uniformly distributed random variables. And this should be independent of Z too. So again, I'm on the last page, page 11 in lecture 9. Step 3 is that then you define the default variables, the variables which are 1 if the obliger I defaults and 0 otherwise. And you do this in the following way. You say that xi equals 1 if the ith uniform random variable is less than p of z. Z is the same for all m variables. And then you say that xi equals 0 if ui is not less than p of z, that is if ui is bigger than z. So then you have defined m default variables which take values 0 or 1. And then the next extra step, which has not been in the rest of the course, is if you can now have random losses. So you believe, you assume that the losses are IID given Z. So you have a distribution of the losses which depends on Z. And the C is the same for all the losses, but conditional on C, they are IID. So you simulate value loss 1, loss 2, and so on up to loss M as a function of C. And then you compute the total loss in the J step. You remember J was a variable which counts where you are in the simulation. So in the first step, you could compute L1, which is just a sum of the default indicators multiplied by these loss variables. So doing this, you get L1, then you repeat, then you get L2, then you repeat, then you get L2, and you go on. Then in the end, you get L, say 10,000. And then this, you have a simulated sequence of loss variables. And then you can get quantiles and whatever you want to do from these these simulated values, and I think you've already done it, so you understand this pretty well. And final comment on this very important page is that you should try to understand why the simulation of the UIs and defining XI as 1 if UI is less than P of Z and XI equals 0 otherwise. You should try to understand why this works. It's important, and it's a generally important thing to do. So this is all I have to say in the wrap-up. Thank you for listening. That's what one says in this part of the course. And good luck with your technical project 2 and with the home exam. Bye.